This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
You usually don't hear the words 74% throttle in reverse. You don't hear those words. Unless someone is trying to launch their SUV into another dimension or escape a crashing train at a railroad track. There's really not a lot of reasons why you're going in reverse at that speed. It's not safe. It's incredibly dangerous. And you can easily lose control. And again, there's not a lot of reasons for it. There are certainly some out there. Some that are very logical. Some that are a little maniacal. It's exactly where today's testimony in the Karen Reed trial begins, with an expert witness walking us through a digital breadcrumb trail left by Reed's Lexus. The kind of forensic story your car tells when it doesn't know it's on trial. The kind of story your car tells without any sort of opinion, without any sort of reason to say this or say that. It just says what it is because it is what it is. It's just flat out data. It's not an opinion. It is data. And when you are a logical, rational human being that can put numbers together and timestamps together and physical locations together, it draws a bit of a picture. And Dr. Judson Welcher drew that picture clearer than ever before in the trial of Karen Reed tonight. Some may say to the point of beyond a reasonable doubt, Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe. Because if you look at the data and the level to which it was gathered and the tests that were done, there ain't a lot of denying it anymore. Well, we'll see what Karen Reed said outside of court in just a few moments. We'll watch the video. It's telling. But first, let's get into the story and tell me in the comment sections what your thoughts are on where things stand now. Is this reasonable doubt or beyond a reasonable doubt at this point? Because here's the way I'm looking at it. The data clearly shows she hit John O'Keefe. There's no way around that anymore. She hit John O'Keefe. If you don't think she hit John O'Keefe, you are living on another planet. This is just pure data now. You're not paying attention. You're not reasonably connecting the dots anymore if you think she did not hit John O'Keefe. If you think it's more logical that all of that science, all of that data matching up the way it does perfectly to her striking John O'Keefe at that very specific time, the vehicle telling us that, his phone telling us that, everything telling us that, Karen's even told us that. But if you still are buying this idea that his friends decided to beat him up in a house, a location which he could not physically possibly be, if we're looking at the timestamps, then I'm sorry. I'm sorry for you. I really am, because I think you got some other things going on if you're still stuck in that corner. Tell me in the comments what your thoughts are. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this case and on YouTube and X as well. I want to hear your thoughts. This to me was like, whoa. Dr. Judson Welcher, the prosecution's crash reconstructionist and biochemical expert, took the stand today to explain what the car knows. And what it knows, according to the data, is that something unusual happened in front of 34 Fairview Road at about 12:32 a.m. on the night Officer John O'Keefe died. Well, Trey analyzed the event data recorder, the automotive equipment of a black box, basically, from Reed's SUV. That data captured a moment where the car accelerated in reverse at 74% throttle or possibly greater, he said. She could have completely floored it. And if you're at 74, you're pretty much almost there. Think about that for a second. John O'Keefe gets out of the car. He's going to go into the party. And suddenly this car launches. It was like 80-some feet in reverse. 24 miles an hour, 74% accelerator on. That's not a, I'm just backing up to say something. That's a, he's behind my car and I'm going to floor it something. That's what takes us to murder too. Because one could still argue she was drunk as hell, because she was. She was angry. And maybe she was thinking that he was on the sidewalk, he was in the lawn, just too dumb at that moment in time to register that John O'Keefe might very likely still be behind the vehicle that he just got out of as he walks towards the vehicle or towards the house. And I don't care what your excuse is. I don't care if you're drunk. I don't care if you're a narcissist. I don't care what the hell has happened to you in your life, that this is how you react to things in a pattern. You did it. Karen, you did it. There's no question about that. It seems you're even questioning that a little bit as well with your comments as you left court today. Because the data is what it is. And even you seem to acknowledge that. Again, we'll play that clip in just a few moments for you. But just think about this. 74% throttle. Most people don't even put that kind of gas into reverse when they're escaping a bear, let alone backing down a roadway as it's snowing in the dark and your passenger just got out behind your vehicle. That throttle pushed the vehicle backwards to just under 24 miles per hour. It's not a gentle roll. That's a deliberate fast reverse covering over 50 feet. And here's the kicker. That moment in the SUV's data lines up perfectly with the last known interaction with John O'Keefe's cell phone. That came from a prior expert, forensic analyst Shannon Burgess, who testified about a 21 to 29 second time discrepancy between the SUV's onboard clock and the phone's actual timestamp. But I guess they're in on the conspiracy, too, if we're still, oh, that's, I mean, don't know why it. Once Welcher adjusted for that gap, he found that the last digital heartbeat from Reed's car lined up tightly with the final lock event in John O'Keefe's phone. In plain English, the last time anyone interacted with O'Keefe's phone is right around the same second mark. Reed's car slammed into reverse in front of the house and struck something. But that's just digital breadcrumbs. You figure out what that reverse maneuver might have done. Welcher didn't just run numbers. He got hands-on, literally. And if you've not seen his testimony today, you have to go back and watch. There's so many visual cues in this that really just blow your mind. And they line up perfectly. You want to see how John got the scratches on the arm? You want to see how his body lined up next to that Lexus SUV? It's explained. He's got to look at it, and it's pretty damning. Even dressed in clothing, similar to what O'Keefe was wearing that night, held a glass like the one O'Keefe had and stood in front of a similar Lexus, then applied some blue paint to the SUV's taillight and had it make contact with his arm. What showed up? That streak, the paint in the same place O'Keefe had a deep laceration. You know, the dog bites from the dog that doesn't have saliva or a bottom jaw. Wait, it does. But in reality. Yeah. It doesn't stop there. Welcher documented marks to the hip and head injuries O'Keefe sustained and showed how the physical layout of the SUV matched those impact zones. So you want to know how John O'Keefe got that injury? Didn't quite match a vehicle impact? No, it wasn't a vehicle impact standing directly behind the vehicle. It was on the side. It was enough to push him to the side and sustain the injuries that he got. And it lines up perfectly. He didn't say this is exactly how he died. He didn't have to. Because what he showed was that on a platter. He showed the actual biomechanics of a backward-moving Lexus, the exact type Karen Reed had. He even went and bought a Lexus, the exact make and model that she had. And then he matched the types of locations of O'Keefe's injuries far more convincingly than, say, the defense's theory that he got mauled by a dog or hit in the head inside of a house with his friends. And then suddenly everybody is out to get Karen Reed, which would involve a cast of more than 50-some people all putting their lives, careers, and everything on the line to frame Karen Reed. If you're still thinking that, you got to ask yourself, what other things in this world are you seeing a little bit off? Wild dog biting a cop in the blizzard. On the front lawn or another cop's house without anyone noticing. And they're dragging him out there. Jen's in her bedroom checking scores and seeing how long it takes for someone to die in the cold. You know, like people, normal people do. That have zero track record of any sort of, you know, criminal culpability or anything of that nature. This is just, you know, normal mom stuff. You think it's a scary world to believe that Karen Reed could be this type of person that hit her boyfriend, realized it, and then fled because she didn't want to be accountable? Do you think that world is scarier than a world where you literally have 50-some people all conspiring against someone, and they're living just a normal, happy, healthy family life? All these different people, many that don't know each other, all conspiring? The lab's in on it. The accident reconstructionists are in on it. That guy's in on it, this guy's in it, everybody's in on it. That's a scary world to think that people could actually, number one, even coordinate themselves that well in a conspiracy. More or less that many people all having this same evil streak in them to do such a thing. Which seems like a lot more evil is to have one person know what really did happen and watch all of these people be harassed, have their lives turned upside down because you can't take responsibility. That's evil. And the fact that you left your boyfriend there in the snow too. I mean, that's pretty sick. Allegedly to all of it. The SUV starts to sound a little more plausible when you look at everything in, you know, perspective. But I know a lot of the FKR folks, perspective is a bad word. Then came the questions of that broken taillight, a centerpiece of the defense's theory. They've claimed the taillight didn't break when O'Keefe was allegedly hit. Instead, they say it shattered hours later when Karen Reed accidentally backed into O'Keefe's parked vehicle as she was leaving his house. They even have the video, 5:07 a.m. surveillance clip showing her vehicle ever so lightly at less than a mile an hour tapping his in the driveway. Welcher took a look at that video. He took the scene, put it under a microscope using 3D laser scanning and high-resolution measurements. Measurements that you could literally take the gas cap on that vehicle and ask for the measurement between that and the cigarette lighter. And you could be down to millimeters based on how accurate this 3D laser scanning high-resolution measurement process is. So he did that. He reconstructed all the angles, the speed, the contact points. His conclusion, and you can watch him go on about it for about an hour explaining all of the calculations and all of the measurements. The garage bump was nothing. It was nothing. Over in John O'Keefe's driveway, it was nothing. The kind of contact that might knock some snow maybe off a bumper, maybe, but would not crack the plastic on your kid's tricycle, let alone a taillight. And more importantly, the two didn't collide at the taillight. The video didn't show any red plastic fragments in the snow, and nobody found any at the scene. To Welcher, it was clear to a high degree of engineering certainty that the taillight was intact when that garage bump happened. Outside garage bump. Which puts the breakage right back at the scene of the alleged impact in front of Fairview Road. Now, all of this data tells a story, but it needs a timeline to hold it together. So Welcher did what good forensic experts do. He clocked the drive. Specifically, how long it would have taken for Reed to go from 34 Fairview Road back to O'Keefe's home after the incident. Depending on the route, the time landed somewhere between 4 and 5 minutes. That travel estimate was used to support the prosecution's claim that Reed made that short drive shortly after the SUV's reverse event. Then here's where the tech comes back into play. Reed's phone reconnected to O'Keefe's home Wi-Fi network just minutes after the alleged impact. The prosecution didn't say this was a smoking gun, but they were certainly waving it around like it still had the smell of gunpowder. One of the things that stood out during Welcher's testimony is how deliberate everything was. This wasn't a I think or I feel kind of expert. He used terms like high degree of engineering certainty, and then he backed it up by showing us exactly why there's that high degree of engineering certainty. Expert speak for I've done my homework, and this isn't a guess, and it's not my first rodeo. Every conclusion he presented was based on data, velocity, throttle, position, trajectory, injury mapping, and good old-fashioned physics, and a lot of graphics, and a lot of graph charts. The Lexus didn't just do something odd in reverse. It allegedly did exactly what you'd expect it to do if it were involved in hitting a person standing near the taillight. There was no bombast in his testimony, no dramatic finger pointing, just one methodical step after another, layering vehicle data over human anatomy, timestamp over timestamp, point of contact over point of injury. What emerged wasn't a theory, it was a tightly constructive narrative made out of numbers, speed, bruising patterns, and paint transfer. So while no one stood up and shouted, "She did it!" the evidence sure did. What Welcher offered today was something arguably more persuasive, a forensic timeline so precisely constructed, it would be difficult to walk through it and not feel like someone had been hit by that car. And as that timeline gets tighter, the room for alternate explanations pretty much disappears, which is exactly where things get heated, not just in the evidence, but in the legal strategy on both sides. That part, that's what we're going to get to next. Before the jury ever took their seats this morning, there were already moments of tenseness in that courtroom. The day opened, not with testimony, but actually with a legal chess match, one of those procedural showdowns where every word, every document, and every slide in a PowerPoint deck suddenly becomes a battlefield. At the center of it, Dr. Judson Welcher, again, same expert, same core testimony, but now under the scrutiny, not for what he said, but for what he challenged. The defense was on its feet before 9 a.m., raising concerns about some recent edits to Welcher's presentation. Apparently, in the days leading up to his testimony, his report, originally 141 slides long, had been trimmed down and tweaked. One slide was pulled entirely, others had minor adjustments. According to the expert, he deleted like two words and a slide. Well, that might sound like housekeeping in a trial like this. It's practically waving a red flag if you think that's a red flag. Robert Alessi, defense counsel, argued that these revisions weren't trivial. He said, the changes, especially if they affected the timeline, could shift the entire narrative of what happened that night outside 34 Fairview Road. It's not a small deal. If the timeline moves, so does the whole theory of the crime, at least on their part. Maybe they should have thought of that before they made it up after the spooky man came to them and said, "Look at the people in the house." Dr. Welcher, for his part, held firm. He acknowledged the edit, sure, but he said they didn't change his conclusions. In fact, the new information pulled from fellow analyst Shannon Burch's findings, described as better data. He told the court he made the update to improve the accuracy of the timeline, not to alter its direction, and he insisted that his opinion was in no way influenced by the prosecution. "It's what the data shows," he said simply. That line might have landed flat in a lesser case or with the FKRs. But in this one, when every single expert is treated like an exhibit themselves, it resonated. Judge Beverly Cannone considered both sides, gave no dramatic speech, and ruled that Welcher's testimony could proceed. The jury was brought in just after 10:20 a.m., and the trial resumed with direct. Now, fast forward to the end of the day, after several hours of expert talk and vehicular physics, we're back in legal trench warfare. This time it's about boundaries, specifically what an expert like Welcher can and cannot say in front of a jury. Alessi stood again, objecting to the question that hadn't even been asked yet. He wanted to stop the prosecution from asking Welcher a very specific question. Did a collision occur? In Alessi's view, that wasn't a scientific conclusion. It was the core issue in the trial. It's what the jury is here to decide. Letting an expert say it outright, he argued, would be handing them the verdict. He didn't say it theatrically. Oh, wait, he kind of did. But the point was clear. Even if an expert is credible, even if their analysis is detailed, some lines shouldn't be crossed. Or at least that's the BS that he was trying to peddle and hoping someone would bite. Alessi stood again, objecting to a question that hadn't even been asked yet. He wanted to stop the prosecution from asking Welcher a very specific question. Did that collision occur? And in Alessi's view, it wasn't a scientific conclusion. It was the core issue of the trial. It's what the jury is here to decide. Letting an expert say it outright, he argued, would be handing them the verdict. Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan didn't sit quietly on that one. He fired back that the defense had spent their better part of the trial claiming there was no crash, no collision, no contact, no reverse even. And if the defense gets to say that, the prosecution should be allowed to rebut it with their own expert's conclusion. Sorry you don't like it. But no, it's just reality. You don't get to pick your own facts. Brennan hinted that Welcher wouldn't just say yes or no. He planned to ask about the type of collision, a clip or sideswipe, for example, the shape of the impact, the dynamics of the event. So not just a yes or a no. No, he's going to explain it in great detail for the jury. So there's no like, well, I wonder how strong he feels about that. Oh, kids, here's the book I just wrote on how this actually happened. Karen doesn't like that. Whether it matches the injuries, but still Alessi wasn't having it. Judge Cannone didn't make a snap call. She took the matter under advisement and said she'd decide in the morning before the jury returned. Meanwhile, in the background, the defense quietly moved a few pieces of their own. They submitted a revised witness list, something you'd miss if you weren't watching it closely. On it, four new names, all reportedly friends or contacts of Michael Proctor, the former Massachusetts State Police trooper who led the original investigation into John O'Keefe's death. The names themselves: Matthew Coleman, Michael Orico, Nicholas David White, Jonathan Diamonds. They weren't familiar to the courtroom, but their role was spelled out clearly. They're being called to authenticate Proctor's personal text messages. These were the high school buddies or something that saw the inappropriate messages that Proctor sent. Here's the thing about this, though. Karen hit him. That's not debatable anymore. So anything over here in the side of shitty investigation, rude, shitty, callous, misogynistic proctor doesn't take away from the vehicle and the phone and everything showing that she hit him. It's shitty. It's bad. But you do this. This does not equal get out of jail free card. Just because they're really shitty. Or maybe that was blown up more than it needed to be. But even if they are super shitty, the shittiest people in the world. And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, just what if your car, his phone, the facts, the data show you did it, Karen. Doesn't matter what happens over here. I don't care if they're summoning flocks of attack seagulls. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what he said. It doesn't matter what he did. It certainly should matter for his employment, and it has. But it doesn't matter here. Because this is facts. This can't be changed. And any facts you sprinkle over here, whether they even planted taillight, which I don't believe they did, but let's say they did because they really hated you and wanted you to go down because they saw what kind of a monster you can be in those interviews. Maybe they knew a little bit more about you than others did. And maybe they had a really bitter taste in their mouth and said, yeah, I hope she goes down because John didn't deserve that. Did not deserve that type of person. And that's not right. I'm not saying that's right. But even if they felt that way, it doesn't matter because the facts showed you hit him. This has nothing to do with this anymore. It just doesn't. You don't get a get out of jail free card because it was a shitty investigation and the people acted strange. Because the data shows you hit him. All of that matters because Proctor's texts are the ticking time bomb of credibility issues. But are they now? Yeah, Proctor has no credibility. But you know who Proctor isn't? He's not Alexis. He's not John's cell phone. He's a shitty cop who said horribly misogynistic things. But his words don't somehow magically reverse time and pull Karen away from reversing and slamming into John O'Keefe and killing him. He can say all the shitty things in the world about you, Karen. And it doesn't change a thing. In one of those text messages, he wrote that he hopes Karen kills herself. In others, he refers to in language so inflammatory that, you know, we're not going to repeat it on the air. They're not texts you'd expect from a neutral investigator. They're not even texts you'd expect from someone trying to cover their tracks. But they also have nothing to do with Karen Reed striking John O'Keefe. And that's been proven today. Well, Proctor has already testified. He acknowledged some of these messages were regrettable. Yeah, the defense appears determined to make sure the jury sees them, not as off-the-cuff rants, but as evidence of bias, potentially institutional bias. All the institutional bias you want doesn't change the fact that Karen hit John O'Keefe. It doesn't. It doesn't matter anymore. And hopefully in the jury's mind, it doesn't either. Because again, no matter how shitty you are over here, doesn't matter. The facts show you hit John O'Keefe and you lied about it.
Allegedly.
They're not just trying to poke holes in the timeline anymore. They're going to go after the entire foundation of the case. If they can just suggest that the investigation itself was tainted by personal grudges, by animosity, by bad faith, by witches conjuring up curses. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. They need to shift the narrative from what did Karen Reed do to what was done to Karen Reed. You know, basically the roadmap for all narcissists. What was done to me? strategy shift was not announced with fireworks, but it's there, quietly humming underneath the rest of the proceedings, and it's starting to take shape exactly the same time that the prosecution appears to be winding down. Brennan has suggested, though not confirmed, that Welcher will be the last witness for the state. If that holds true, the prosecution may rest as early as this week, which means the defense's turn is coming, and with it, a very different story. And does that story matter anymore? Certainly not as much as it did the last time. Because that testimony today, that data today, it's irrefutable. First, the judge still needs to decide just how far an expert can go in telling their story. And we'll see what is allowed to be said. As today's expert witness winds down their testimony tomorrow and eventually steps into cross, what do you think? I think today was the game changer for a reasonable human being. I don't know how, honestly, anyone still can think she didn't strike John. And in Karen's own words today, she had this to say outside of court in her never-ending moments of genius. Let's take a look.
So did you go in reverse 24 miles an hour, 53 feet?
The data is what the data is, and it's going to come out cleanly, more cleanly, in our case in chief.
Leslie and AJ are standing there. It's like the most forced smiles. It's like they're at a Hardee's in 1987, and so they're bringing out, like, the cake, and it's, like, just really disappointing, and it's sad, and the ball tank's closed down because somebody peed in it. But you're trying to, like, be an enthusiastic parent, like, look, isn't this cake wonderful? You need a cattle prod or something. Like, shut up! Shut up! Because you can tell there's pain and artificial happiness as they're watching her. Just look at their faces. They're just like, do we have to push her down the steps quick to make her stop talking?
I think it's important to demonstrate, what is the Commonwealth accusing me of? The speed, the positioning, we create that for us. Back up into the crash test dummy at 24.2 miles an hour in the arm and see what happens. That's what I would want to see if I were you.
Oh, really? Maybe they can go do that for you, because you know what? Today, they pretty much showed what happened. And when you go in slow motion, you see exactly where that vehicle struck John O'Keefe. So what you just asked for today basically is what happened. And they wouldn't strike crash test dummy at 24 miles. Now, I mean, that would be a bit different thing, but if you want that set up, I'm sure they could. You can see it in much greater detail just of how that would happen in slow motion. And you know what? He had all of the science, all of the programs, all of that. This showed down to every minute calculation. Who was moving where, what part was going this way and that way, at what speed, at what trajectory, and where they would all land. So, Karen, they did that today. While you were on your computer, probably stocking up on snack sticks and ramen for your little stay that's coming up. Oh, there's more.
Do you recall that at all, Karen, though?
No.
This is why you cannot argue with narcissists. Because they can just go like, well, the data is the data, and it will show what it shows. Do you remember going in reverse? No, I don't, because it didn't happen. Karen, it did happen. And if you don't remember it happening, then you don't remember anything about what happened that night. And you don't remember him going in the house, because he didn't go in the house. And you probably don't even remember hitting him. But you did. At this point, it's like arguing with a 3-year-old. Did you take the candy off the counter? No! Why are your hands all full of chocolate? I don't know. you took the candy off the counter. It didn't happen. Okay, Karen.
Any update on if you're calling Proctor, given that his friends are now witnesses on your list?
No comments.
No, come on, these four new witnesses. Say anything about them?
No comments.
Are you going to take the stand?
No comments.
No comments.
Oh, she said that with joy. I thought it was interesting. It was no comment on if Proctor's good. They're going to call Proctor. And there's no comment on if she'll take the stand. And if you noticed, in that very moment right there, Karen, with all of her narcissistic glee of, oh, there could be sole attention on me on the stand. No comment. Little hair wave there. As it was just revealed in court today, without a doubt, your vehicle struck John O'Keefe. No comment. Why would anyone still support this woman? Because if she knows what she did, and then she stood by and watched all these people go through this hell, and she knew all along, and you're accusing all these other people of murder, which, by the way, is a crime in itself, which I hope to God you're charged for. Kind of a big deal, Karen. See if there's anything else here.
Sorry. Somebody asked me if I'm going to take this.
Can I say thank you, Chef?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Touché.
Touché. Thank you, Chef.
Thank you, Chef.
There you go.
Wouldn't be surprised if Karen calls in sick tomorrow. I would not be surprised if it was another straight tequila night. Bad country song there. I don't know what to say. My mind was blown today with the testimony and the behavior after. I shouldn't be shocked, but it's just so disheartening that there can be humans like that out there. You hope to see better in people. That was not a good person. And of course, allegedly to everything we've talked about tonight. Even though the data shows you hit John O'Keefe. And the experts said it too. And then he got shut down really quick by Alessi. And we'll see if the judge comes back and says, yeah, you can say that without a doubt. Because he said it. He said it. In fact, you want to see it? You want to see it happen? This won't be long. This is what was said today in court. And pull it up here on the screen so you can see it.
But based on your analysis, data available, reviews, study, based on the fact that you are an accident reconstructionist and a biomedical engineer, have you reached an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty whether the defendant's Lexus struck Mr. John O'Keefe on January 29, 2022, around 12:32 a.m.
Yes.
And could you share the basis of your opinion before I ask you your ultimate opinion?
Sure. So, again, you've seen my slide presentation. I've inspected the Lexus. I've looked at where it was and wasn't damaged. I've inspected the taillight. I got an exemplar Lexus. I ran lower speed contacts to verify that the injury pattern and location on the arm is consistent with the height and orientation of the taillight. I have looked at fracture tolerance data for falling backwards onto hard surfaces. I've looked at the metrics of where his injuries were and what injuries he didn't sustain. I've looked at the cell phone data, and then I've looked at Ms. Reed's interviews as well.
Based on all the evidence you considered, could you share with the jury what your opinion is to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty about whether the defendant's Lexus struck Mr. O'Keefe on January 29, 2022, around 12:32 a.m.?
Objection, Your Honor.
Going to 11.
I can ask.
Yes, based on the totality of the evidence, DNA, everything I've talked about, that is consistent with that happening. With a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, that is what happened.
Strike that. I want to see Compton's head off for just.
And that's where the day pretty much ended with the jury in the courtroom. Follow the science. There it is. I rest my case. No, but I think Brennan might be resting his case pretty soon. What's your thoughts? How did it go? Tell me in the comment section on YouTube or X, wherever you're watching this. Press subscribe on any of the podcast platforms so you don't miss any of our coverage. If you just want to follow the Karen Reed case, we have the channel specifically for that. Maybe you're already there. The trial of Karen Reed. That's us. Or if you want to follow all of the cases that we have for you, then search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi wherever you get your podcasts or your videos. And you'll find us on YouTube as well. Excited to hear your thoughts on how it went down today. It'll be another exciting one tomorrow, so we'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Day number 22 of the trial of Karen Reed. And what a day it was. I want to know the exact moment things got real in the Karen Reed trial. It wasn't when the witness stumbled or when the defense raised eyebrows about conspiracies. It was when Judson Welcher, a biomechanics and crash reconstruction expert, took the stand and walked the jury through hard, time-stamped vehicle data. You know, exciting stuff. And in this case, it surely is. And it just so happened to sync perfectly with the moment John O'Keefe's phone went dead. No fluff, no storytelling, just numbers, cold, digital, damning numbers. Exactly 12:32:14 a.m. on January 29th, 2022, Karen Reed's Lexus SUV accelerated backwards at nearly 24 miles per hour for over 50 feet. At the same moment, down to the second, O'Keefe's phone suddenly stopped moving. No more steps, no more signals, just nothing. That wasn't some theory. This was forensic data pulled directly from the Lexus's internal computer and O'Keefe's phone. And that's where Welcher's testimony started separating speculation from science. We're going to get into all of it today. Excited to hear your comments on this one, whether it be on YouTube, please leave them there, or X, or wherever you're watching us, or if you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, please press subscribe there. And do check us out on YouTube and X and such, so you can watch what we're doing here. We have a lot of great interviews on this show. Just had some great ones today with Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. And he had some very interesting insights on where things are going in this case. And we talked a lot of things from a behavioral standpoint. So watch for those videos and audio cuts here coming up on the podcast and on YouTube. Anyway, getting back to this, and again, comments, I want to hear what you think. Welcher didn't come in throwing accusations. In fact, he couldn't. The judge laid down the rules early that morning. Judge Beverly Cannoni told the courtroom that Welcher could say whether the crash data was consistent with the collision. But he wasn't allowed to outright claim Reed's SUV struck O'Keefe. Basically, he had to show his math, not write the answer on the board, and say, hey, look at this book over here that has the exact same problem with the answer. That's exactly the same as this book over here. Same make, same model. And the answer that you're looking for, it's right. So, yeah. That's what they was allowed to say. Obviously, the jury can see through what that strange way of speak needs to be in legalese. But they went through with it. Of course, that's how it works. And exactly what happened? Welcher walked the jury through how Reed's Lexus performed a three-point turn, like she was turning around in the street. And then, just minutes later, stomped the gas in reverse with nearly three-quarters throttle. It's not some light tap to reposition in a driveway. That's pressing the pedal down hard, enough to launch a two-ton SUV backwards across a small cul-de-sac. And here's where it gets tighter. The vehicle data logs that acceleration, it's there at precisely the same time O'Keefe's phone activity flatlined. Welcher didn't try to dramatize it. He just laid it out, wasn't giving a TED talk. He was dropping receipts. And when asked what that meant, he said, as an engineer and a crash expert, the data was consistent with a pedestrian being struck. Not a certainty, but consistent. That's important because everything from that point forward builds onto that timestamp. Now, a neutral question is, okay, but how does that data match up to the injuries that O'Keefe had? Welcher had that covered, too. One of the more compelling moments in this testimony came when he described a demonstration he conducted using a Lexus RX350, identical to Reed's vehicle. He applied blueprint to the taillight, then stood in the path of the SUV, lining up where O'Keefe would have actually been. Welcher is about the same height and weight as O'Keefe, so it wasn't some guess. It was measured, controlled, and as the SUV backed up slowly, it brushed against his forearm. The blue paint transferred onto the back of his arm in the same spot where O'Keefe's had scratches and abrasions. It was visual, simple, and matched the autopsy photos. The defense might scoff at the method, but the takeaway was clear. The taillight made contact in a way that explained those exact injuries. It wasn't random. Welcher made it very clear that he wasn't trying to recreate a full-speed crash. That would have been absurd. And probably a liability nightmare, don't you think? This wasn't Mythbusters. He wasn't launching dummies through windshields. The goal wasn't to replicate the speed. It was to demonstrate alignment, contact points, injury zones. And in that context, his controlled test showed that even a light touch from the taillight hit the same area where O'Keefe was bruised and scraped. Exact same spots. It's enough to show that the vehicle and the injuries told the same story. Another piece of the puzzle was O'Keefe's injury pattern. One of the things the defense has tried to lean on the idea that O'Keefe didn't have a broken leg or arm like that and somehow rules out being hit by a car. And they insert Chloe the dog there quite often as well. But Welcher shut down fast. Shut that whole theory down. He referenced a prior case he worked on where a man was hit by a car going 25 miles an hour. The man died of a head injury but didn't have a single broken bone on his legs. The absence of fractures doesn't mean the impact didn't happen. It just means the force hit differently. In O'Keefe's case, Welcher said the injuries were entirely consistent with being struck and then falling to frozen ground. That matters because the idea of a glancing blow where the vehicle doesn't crush the person but still knocks them down with significant force or launches them into a yard matches what the forensic pathologist found. Skull fractures, brain swelling, abrasions, and lacerations, but no shattered limbs. In other words, the data says impact, and the body says impact. Just not necessarily the Hollywood-style impact the defense wants people to imagine. Then came the taillight itself. According to Reed, her taillight was broken when she backed into another car right outside her garage. Sounds convenient, right? Well, Welcher explained why that doesn't hold up either. The taillight wasn't just cracked, it was shattered, the kind of brake pattern, a fragment distribution you'd expect from a high-force contact. Not a fender kiss in a garage or outside. He even walked the jury through the materials involved. Polycarbonate lenses, brittle points of failure, directional force. The takeaway, this wasn't caused by a slow bump in the driveway. It was more likely caused by contact with something or someone outside under dynamic pressure. The Lexus's own crash system hadn't logged any crash data, which the defense probably thought was a golden ticket, but again, Welcher preempted that too. Those black box systems only record when there's a significant force event, typically a crash with another car or a stationary object. A glancing blow to a human being, especially one that doesn't trigger airbags or engage sensors, wouldn't register, and that's exactly what happened here. The absence of the log crash data wasn't evidence that nothing happened. It was evidence that what happened fell outside the threshold of the car's software. That's a nuance that sounds like a loophole unless you understand crash engineering, and Welcher does. The best part? He didn't oversell it. He didn't walk in saying he had all the answers. In fact, he openly said what he couldn't determine, like the exact path of the vehicle after impact. He didn't speculate. He didn't say, this is where the car went, or this is exactly how O'Keefe landed. He said, here's what the data shows. Here's how it matches what we physically see on the body. And here's why that matters. It's the difference between telling a story and reconstructing an event. When you step back and look at the whole picture Welcher painted, it's built entirely on corroborating evidence, digital vehicle data, synchronized phone timestamps, paint transfer experiments, autopsy reports. Nothing he said required you to take a leap of faith or fill in the blanks with assumptions. And that's what made his testimony compelling. He didn't have to point fingers. He just followed the science. Now, of course, not everyone in that courtroom wanted to hear what he had to say, because when the evidence lines up too perfectly, the only way to push back is to go after the person presenting it. And that's exactly where things got headed next. There are court moments designed to inform, and there are court moments designed to distract. Today, Judson Welcher walked into a courtroom armed with data, diagrams, and years of experience and accident reconstruction. The defense, led by Robert Alessi today, walked in with a metaphor about launching a car into outer space. Wasn't a joke. Actually happened. Here's how it started. During cross-examination, Alessi zeroed in on a hypothetical about what might happen if Reed's Lexus struck John O'Keefe in the location where his body was found. Wouldn't the vehicle moving backwards at over 20 miles per hour have continued onto the lawn? Alessi was trying to suggest that if O'Keefe ended up on the roadway, then Reed's vehicle must have followed. So where are the tire marks, right? That's when Welcher, trying to carefully explain the distance or the difference between what is physically possible versus what is probable, he responded like an engineer. He said that, sure, in the realm of pure physics, it's possible the car could have traveled any number of paths after impact. It's possible. He said, it could have shot into space, too. And he clarified immediately that this was an illustration of a concept, not a literal belief. But Alessi seized on that phrasing like a cat with a laser pointer. So you're telling us that this Lexus could have shot into space? And just like that, the conversation about biomechanics and injury zones became a circus about interstellar travel. Truth is, Welcher's comment was a way to stress that engineers don't speak in absolutes. When data doesn't support it, he wasn't guessing. He was refusing to speculate. That distinction, that very refusal to fill in the blanks with assumptions, is something any honest scientist should be doing in court. But Alessi didn't want rigor. He wanted ridicule. The jury saw a seasoned expert trying to explain real-world limitations. The defense tried to turn it into a comedy. But the joke, if there was one, landed awkwardly. And at the end of the day, on the defense. You know, when an argument by pretending an expert is irrational, or when he's actually very, very precise. The timeline argument wasn't much better unless he tried to draw attention to a late-stage correction made by Welcher's firm, Aperture. Small timing discrepancy, around 21 to 29 seconds, was corrected just weeks before the trial. According to the defense, this was either suspicious or opportunistic. They suggested that the revised timeline was too convenient, too clean. Like the experts had massaged the numbers to perfectly sync Reed's reverse acceleration with O'Keefe's phone going silent. But Welcher never flinched. He explained without drama that the data itself hadn't changed, just the interpretation. Once his colleague discovered that the vehicle's internal clock had a slight drift compared to the phone with O'Keefe, they adjusted the event timestamps accordingly. That's not trickery, that's quality control. It's like realizing your watch is 2 minutes fast and adjusting it before showing up late to a meeting. Not exactly grounds for a conspiracy theory, but hey, in Karen Land, everything's a conspiracy. More importantly, the defense never provided evidence that the correction was inaccurate or dishonest. They just didn't like that the updated timeline made the state's case stronger. But we don't like this data is not the same as disapproving it. And once again, the defense's strategy wasn't to bring their own data to the table. It was to question the existence of data they didn't have a better answer for. Then there was the money. Alessi brought up the $325,000 contract between Aperture and Norfolk County DA's office like it was a smoking gun. He emphasized how much the expert was being paid, how they had even purchased a Lexus RX 350 to run tests. So this wasn't about finding the truth. It was the implication went, this was about something very different. It's about causing and cashing a check and causing a scene. Welcher didn't deny the numbers. Why would he? It's not like they were hidden. He explained how the project expanded in scope, how hours were billed, how the cost of buying and reselling the test vehicle was factored in. He explained it the way any professional consultant in this technical field would. This isn't something that someone's charging for time spent twiddling their thumbs. This is months of physical testing, data analysis in multiple offices in multiple states, vehicle diagnoses, the courtroom prep, all of it. It costs what it does. And this is really, for the amount of work that they did, not crazy. May sound shocking. There you go. There's a good business to get into, kids. Be an expert witness. Seriously, if you're an expert in something that could maybe qualify you for that, not a bad gig. Anyway, the defense was clearly hoping jurors would conflate money with dishonesty, but they never showed that Welcher was paid to reach a specific conclusion. There was no quid pro quo, no bonus for conviction, just a contracted expert doing forensic analysis. The courtroom reaction made it clear that just saying a number out loud doesn't magically discredit the testimony attached to it, especially when the number comes with receipts and reproducible results. Still trying to chip away at the science, Alessi moved to typography. He challenged the Welcher about the 4-inch berm in the yard at 34 Fairview. His question, essentially, was whether a slight elevation difference would throw off Welcher's injury analysis. Welcher's response was calm and clear. Yes, the berm was considered, and no, it didn't invalidate the conclusion. A few inches of grade change might shift the contact point a bit, but it wouldn't undo the physics of a vehicle-pedestrian collision. Again, that's not speculation, that's just how force works. And then came the bones argument. Alessi tried to make the big deal out of the fact that John O'Keefe didn't have broken legs or arms. Welcher had already addressed this, both on direct and again during cross. You don't need shattered limbs to die from being hit by a car. The impact, depending on the angle and the part of the body that takes it, can result in brain trauma without touching the legs. And Welcher had seen it before, even cited a previous case where a man was hit at 25 miles per hour and died of head injuries with no bone fractures at all. The implication that no broken bones means no vehicle impact just is not supported by biomechanics. But it was another swing from the defense to get jurors thinking absolutes. As if being struck by a car always leads to the same checklist of injuries. It doesn't. Still, Alessi didn't stop there. I mean, seriously, he should have stopped a long time ago. He only reinforced this guy's knowledge and opinion to the jury twice, and probably even stronger the second time around when he's on cross. I don't know what Alessi was thinking, if he thought he'd still hit that golden ticket at some point, but spoiler alert, he doesn't. Still, Alessi continues. He pushed Welcher on why he didn't conclude exactly where the Lexus ended up after the impact. Why didn't the report say if the SUV ended up in the yard or stayed on the road? Welcher answered plainly, because he couldn't know for sure. There wasn't enough data to say definitively, and he wasn't going to guess. It's that same line in the sand. Welcher testifies to what the evidence shows, not what someone wants him to say, but the defense tried to make it appear that restraint looked like a gap. As if not knowing everything somehow meant knowing nothing. That's not how science works. Not knowing the post-impact stopping point doesn't erase what's known about the speed, the injury, or the timestamp. Outside the courtroom, Karen Reed herself chimed in, as expected. She mocked Welcher's experiment with the Lexus, said if he really wanted to recreate that event, he should have backed into a crash dummy at 24 miles an hour. She was sarcastic, dismissive, talking to cameras, not experts, but her critique ignored the actual purpose of the test, because they've all been so valuable so far, those critiques from Karen. Which is a way to analyze alignment, not replicate the full force of the impact. No one is backing into an SUV, into a human being, to prove a point in court. And you couldn't really do it with a test dummy in any sort of accurate way either. Welcher never claimed he did. The experiment was about visual alignment and matching contact areas. And it worked. They don't like that it worked, but it worked. The test matched the exact injuries on O'Keefe's arm. And that's what matters. At the end of the day, Welcher didn't bend under pressure. He acknowledged what he didn't know, stood firm on what he did, and never took the bait when the defense tried to goad him into speculation. It's not just a sign of credibility. It's a sign of someone who understands that truth doesn't need theatrics. It just needs to be shown. And in some cases, admitted to. What did you think about the testimony today in the Karen Reed case? Let us know. Let me know in the comments. I'd love to see it. And again, please press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching this so you don't miss any of the coverage we got for you on this and all of the cases that we cover here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening. We will talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Day 23, the trial of Karen Reed. And what a day it was. Did we all see the same thing? I'm kind of wondering when you look online at comments about this day. Can't say I'm that surprised, but it is a little stunning just how dramatic two different worlds seem to be on this case. It's hard to imagine a more theatrical mic drop in a courtroom than this. After 23 days, 38 witnesses, and hours upon hours of technical data, forensic breakdowns, and legal fencing, the prosecution in the Karen Reed trial ended their case not with an expert or a detective or even some flashy visual aid. They ended it with Karen Reed's own words. Not words paraphrased by someone else, not some dramatized quote, her literal voice, her face, her admission on video. And we're going to watch that video in just 1 second. Before we do, I got to ask, please hit subscribe wherever you're watching this, wherever you may have downloaded this or done with podcasts. My mind's going different places because my mind's over here grabbing this video while I'm trying to talk. It's a lot of multitasking, and sometimes my brain just locks up. All right. Anyway, be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening to this in the world of podcasts, Apple, Spotify, wherever it is. Please hit subscribe there. And hey, check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That's where you're going to find all of our content on video so you can watch it and see even more than what we have on the podcast channel and vice versa. And in the comments, please, please, please tell me what you're thinking about this case, because it is, yeah, it's continuing to get crazier. Here's the clip that the prosecution closed with today. Let's take a look at that.
So I thought, could I have run him over? Did he try to get me as I was leaving and I didn't know it? I mean, I've always got the music blasting. It's snowing. I've got the wipers going, the heater blasting. Did he come and hit the back of my car and I hit him in the knee and he's drunk and passed out and asphyxiated or something? And then I hired David Yannetti. I asked him those questions the night of January 29th. Like, David, what if, I don't know, what if I ran his foot over, or what if I clipped him in the knee and he passed out and or went to care for himself and he threw up or passed out? And David said, yeah, they have some element of culpability.
And here's the words.
So the 207.
Your Honor, the Commonwealth rests.
Boom. That'll be interesting to see who plays him in the movies and the Lifetime specials and the Netflix drama series. And eventually, a feature film on HBO. I wonder who would play who. We should put that out on X or Twitter on social and just see everybody fill in the blank and see who would play who. Or hell, I mean, this video is out there, so post it under here. Who would play who? In the comments, I'd be really I'd be curious about that. Oh, that'd be interesting. That to me almost plays like a. Like a commercial for a law firm. I was worried and worried. And then I called David Yannetti. David Yannetti Law Firm. Yannetti and Yannetti. I don't know what it is. But that's where like the voiceover would hit in. And then it would go back to Karen. And then somehow it ends up not with the solution of, well, you're not, you know, there's nothing to worry about. It's like, well, yeah, then you'd be comfortable. If you want to lose, but then the doc where that piece plays, there is it kind of flashes then over to Alan Jackson, and then Alan Jackson is kind of the hero saying, "No, we got a case." I'm gonna play with that. I think I might be able to make a fun little fake commercial. That might be a weekend project. All right, let's continue on with what has been going on. So picture this. The jury is sitting quietly focused, already worn down from weeks of testimony. And they're shown a brief 50-second clip. It's not a reenactment or a simulation. It's Karen Reed herself, filmed back in 2024, talking through her own lingering doubts. She just heard. She says, "What if I clipped him in the knee?" You could practically feel the weight of those words hanging in the air. It wasn't the prosecution making a claim. It wasn't an expert forming a conclusion. It was the defendant pondering her own potential culpability out loud, voluntary, and with cameras rolling. Karen's favorite thing. And it wasn't just that she asked the question. She went further. She recalled asking her attorney back on the day John O'Keefe's body was discovered whether she might have accidentally hit him. According to her, her lawyer responded, yeah, then you'd have some element of culpability. Not exactly the script of someone denying everything without hesitation. It's kind of the moment that, whether it's technically a confession or not, lands heavy in a case built on data, patterns, and timelines. This was a moment of raw personal narrative that no reconstruction model could compete with. When that video ended, the courtroom didn't erupt. No shouting, no gasps, just silence. The kind of silence that only happens when something hits dead center. Jurors reportedly stared at the blank screen long after it went dark. It's not just attention, that's impact. That's a jury absorbing something they can't unhear. And that was exactly the point. The prosecution, led by Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan, could have rested their case on the back of Dr. Judson Welcher, the crash reconstruction expert who'd spent 3 days being grilled and held his ground. But they didn't. They took it a step further. They chose to closed with Karen Reed's own narrative. The one moment they knew couldn't be cross-examined, spun, or interpreted. And the video played, and the moment sunk in. Brennan turned to the judge and simply said, "The Commonwealth rests. No fireworks, no grandstanding, just a calculated close." That little piece didn't just land because of what she said. It landed because of when and how it was said, confirming a long, intense day of cross-examination. It hit like a pin through the balloon of the courtroom chaos. If you're trying to frame the end of your case as the moment where truth speaks loudest, it doesn't get clearer than that. The defendant asking herself whether she ran someone over, and using the word culpability in the same breath. Now, Karen hasn't testified yet. She very likely won't. That decision, according to her, is still TBD. Same for whether Trooper Michael Proctor, the much-discussed and often criticized lead investigator, will take the stand for the defense. Standing outside the courthouse after the prosecution wrapped, Reed had one word, to describe the case against her. Unjust. Just that, nothing more. No speech today. No tears, just a clean rejection of everything that's been built against her over the past several weeks. The contrast was hard to ignore. Inside the courtroom, the prosecution dropped a weighty first-hand account. Outside the courthouse, the defendant waved it all off with a single word. And for what's next, Reed's team is set to begin presenting their side of the story. First up, a witness from a film called Delta V. Specializing, or a firm rather, not a film. Kind of sounds like a film, though, doesn't it? A film. A firm called Delta V, specializing in crash forensic, digital data, and vehicle telemetry. Presumably, he'll offer a counter-analysis to what Dr. Welcher laid out over the past few days. If the prosecution painted the picture of a high-speed reverse into John O'Keefe, Delta V is likely stepping in to say, that's not how we see it. The defense case is expected to last another 1 to 2 weeks. That means the jury is now flipping their mental switch from evaluating to the prosecution's claims to considering an entirely different set of arguments, timelines, and possibly new theories about what really happened the night John O'Keefe died. But the challenge for the defense is now baked into that last moment from the prosecution. Every argument they presented going forward has to compete with a simple, unpolished, and unforced moment of personal doubt from Karen Reed herself. It's hard to paint over your own voice. The words, "What if I clipped him?" are not exactly the kind of thing you can spin as someone being railroaded by the system. They're introspective. They're self-incriminating. And they came out long before any expert ever touched the case. So now the prosecution steps back, having built their case with everything from DNA and taillight fragments to tech logs and cell phone pings, and capped it off with the defendant offering the jury a question no one else could ask on her behalf. As the court prepares for the defense to take over, what a jury was left with wasn't a chart or a diagram, just that voice. A voice that sounded unsure, maybe frightened, but undeniably real. That voice may echo long after the PowerPoint slides fade. And for prosecutors, that was the goal. Not to dramatize, not to speculate, just to remind the jury that no matter how complicated this case may be, the defendant herself had once looked in the mirror and asked the question, "What if?" Now that question is in the jury's hands. And the next day, defense is going to be trying to rewrite the story. If the prosecution ended its case with a mic drop, the defense spent the earlier part of the day fumbling with the cord. Thursday morning in the Karen Reed trial didn't start with fireworks, but it started with friction. Before the jury was even brought into the room, there was already tension. Defense attorney Robert Alessi was pushing hard to expand the scope of what he could ask the prosecution's final expert witnesses, or witness, crash reconstructionist, Dr. Judson Welcher. He wanted to question Welcher about conclusions reached by other people, specifically Trooper Joseph Paul and the medical examiner, Dr. Scorty Bello. The argument, Alessi claimed, Welcher had relied on their work when forming his own analysis, and therefore opened the door to questions about their findings. The prosecution, though, pushed back, saying Welcher hadn't adopted those findings, but instead formed his own independent conclusions. The judge wasn't having it for the defense. She sided with the Commonwealth, ruling that Welcher's testimony would have to stand on its own. Alessi was blocked from turning Welcher into a surrogate across for other witnesses. That legal boundary set the tone for what followed. And what followed was a cross-examination that did not go well for the defense. Once the jury was seated, Alessi resumed his questioning of Welcher, but his tone noticeably changed. Where day one of cross-examination might have seemed probing, day two was clearly combative. Alessi frequently interrupted, challenged Welcher mid-answer, and even drew repeated rebukes from Judge Cannoni for not letting the witness finish. At one point, when Welcher raised his hand to clarify something, Alessi snapped. You're going to see this in just 1 second. "Sir, please don't interrupt." The judge intervened again. You could feel the courtroom tightening. It's like watching someone arguing too loud in a library with a megaphone, on top of tables, standing on books, and throwing firecrackers at people. That kind of a tension. It wasn't just ineffective. It was uncomfortable. It was very weird and very uncomfortable. And here's exactly what it looked like.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
You had 3D images, correct?
I did.
You could have shown and measured 3D images to get almost the exact contact point and almost the exact dimensions if you had just used the 3D images that you had available to you. Isn't that correct?
That's exactly what we did. When I went through the video analysis, I showed you how we overlaid the point clouds, the 3D scans, on top of each vehicle. So we took the, I'm sorry, let me We took the vehicles.
Sir, please don't interrupt.
Hold on.
Your Honor, he keeps referencing my hand and saying I'm doing something when I'm not, and I think that's distracting to the jury. So, I'm not interrupting
him. Hold on. Let the witness answer the question.
I am. I'm just holding my hand like this, Your Honor. He keeps saying that I'm doing something.
Mr. Lessie, please.
All right.
Go ahead. Finish the answer, Dr. Lessie.
Again, in the photogrammetric analysis, I showed the video. I showed how we overlaid the point cloud on top of the video. That proves that the way we solved it, correct camera characteristics, matches. Otherwise, that would be distorted. We overlaid the scans of the Lexus into the photogrammetric analysis. We overlaid the scans of the scene into the photogrammetric analysis. We overlaid all that stuff into the analysis. We did exactly what you're suggesting.
That's why it's not a great idea to start going after an expert witness in an area you are not remotely familiar with. I mean, I get it. You got to try and poke holes somewhere, but so many of the questions that he was asking him didn't make sense. And they didn't make sense to a lot of people who aren't even engineers. It was a spectacle. It was a spectacle. Despite the pressure, Welcher did hold firm. He didn't fold, didn't fluster, and more importantly, he didn't give the defense what it wanted. A moment of doubt, contradiction, anything that might rattle the scaffolding the prosecution had spent weeks building. Alessi came armed with angles. He tried to poke holes in the reverse throttle data. And the fact that Reed's Lexus had recorded a sudden acceleration in reverse, hitting 74% throttle and reaching nearly 24 miles per hour just after 12:30 a.m. on the night John O'Keefe was allegedly struck. Welcher had explained that the data on direct testifying that it strongly supported the prosecution's theory that Reed reversed into O'Keefe with significant force. Alessi tried to undercut that by comparing it to what he called trigger events that had shown up on the vehicle's tech stream data before that night, 18 of them to be exact, that had never been considered collisions. If those didn't register as accidents, Alessi argued, how could this one be taken as definitive proof? Welcher calmly explained that the system doesn't register collisions based on impact alone. It flags events based on sudden changes in vehicle behavior, things like harsh braking, steering, or rapid accelerations. The January 29th event had all three. The earlier 18 did not. The defense then shifted to the now famous Ring camera footage, the surveillance footage from O'Keefe's own home, which captured Reed's SUV nudging his parked Chevy Traverse later that morning around 5:07 a.m. The defense claims that this is when the taillight broke, not earlier in the night during an alleged collision with O'Keefe. Welcher testified that such a minor bump wouldn't have caused the level of damage seen to the taillight, based on testing and reconstruction, you know, science. But Alessi focused on something else, the camera, specifically the fact that the original camera from January 2022 had since been replaced with a newer Ring camera. Alessi tried to use that as a wedge, suggesting that Welcher's analysis of angles and distances could be off because the camera used for the simulation wasn't the exact same one from the night in question. Welcher acknowledged that the hardware difference was there, but said it didn't affect his analysis. He used available data and visual references to reconstruct the scene, and any distortion differences from camera models had been accounted for. He reminded the court that in his simulation, the Lexus's taillight came within about an inch of the Traverse, but didn't make contact, reinforcing his point that if that bump had shattered the light, there would have been far more visible movement or debris captured. Alessi pushed back, asking why the still image didn't clearly show space between the vehicles. Welcher's answer? Two-dimensional images compress depth. That's why he was providing multiple angles. The physical math didn't lie, even if the snapshot itself lacked depth cues. Not done yet, though. Alessi moved to the subject of the glass fragments, another key piece of forensic evidence. Investigators had recovered glass from the taillight area of Reed's Lexus, and some of those shards, prosecutors argued, came from the glass O'Keefe was allegedly holding when struck. But during cross, Alessi zeroed in on something technical. Welcher never personally examined the glass. That's true, he didn't. He reviewed reports, photos, and data, but he didn't get hands-on with the fragments. Alessi used that to suggest Welcher's conclusions about the crash and the glass were speculative. Welcher pushed back, saying the trajectory of the glass and how it was embedded matched the expected physics of a collision, not a minor tap in a driveway hours later. And came the accusation of bias, because why not? Alessi leaned hard into the idea that Welcher was a hired gun. He brought up that Aperture LLC, Welcher's firm, was paid $44,000 in late 2024, followed by an additional $325,000 this year to assist in the prosecution. That kind of money, the defense implied, buys loyalty. Really? Because this is pretty normal stuff. And he damn well knows that, and he damn well hopes the jury has no idea how much expert witnesses get paid. And like I said, it's a good business to be in if you are an expert in something. I am not, and nobody's going to call an expert podcaster over. So if you got something, might be a career path. Because, yeah, if you didn't know how much expert witnesses get paid, this is not insane. The first time I heard about it, too, I was kind of shocked. I mean, I knew that they got paid something for their time, but I was kind of shocked just how much some get paid. And sometimes they don't even have to do a ton of research. It's just getting their voice into it. I know. Anyway, it's not an oddity in this case. Welcher didn't blink. He testified that he was initially hired to evaluate the possibility that Reed hadn't struck O'Keefe. He said his first working hypothesis was that there had been no collision, but as he worked through the evidence, taillight fragments found near the body, DNA on the rear of Reed's car, the throttle data, he ruled that hypothesis out. The data led him to a different conclusion. Then, in a moment that felt like a turning point, unless he tried to imply that the entire foundation of the forensic of the prosecution's forensic case was circumstantial, he framed it like a trap, asking whether all of his conclusions were just based on circumstantial information. Welcher did not dodge. He fired back with a rhetorical gut punch. Are you calling pieces of taillight found around the body circumstantial? I don't know why he suddenly Inspector Gadget or something, Sherlock Holmes. It landed hard. He reminded everyone that the physical evidence, the fragments, the DNA, the injury patterns all told the same story. This wasn't speculation. It was material reality. After the grueling morning, Alessi wrapped up. The cross was over. Yeah, it has more than one meeting right there. Then prosecutor Hank Brennan stepped up for a brief redirect, not long but strategic. He confirmed that Welcher stood by his analysis, that he didn't rely on any encrypted message apps to communicate about the case. A sub-dig at the defense communication with their experts, and that he had full confidence in the data, the scans, and the 3D reconstruction. Welcher reiterated that he didn't include any theory in his report unless the evidence supported it. If something didn't fit, it got tossed. With all of the questioning complete, Judge Cannone finally dismissed Welcher from the stand. His parting words, "Oh my God, thank you." And it was. I'm not making that up. And it got a few laughs, a lot of people. 3 days of full testimony, a room full of legal sharks, and relentless scrutiny would drain anyone. But what Welcher left behind wasn't fatigue. It was a body of testimony that held. The defense had its shot to unravel him, to catch him slipping, to inject doubt in the technical backbone of the case. They didn't get it. What they got was a witness who stayed consistent, stayed calm, and stayed credible. Whether the jury agrees with his conclusions or not, one thing became clear: the state's expert didn't crack. And with him now gone, the courtroom shifted into a new phase. It was time for the defense to start building something of their own. And that's what's going to be happening next. The defense's case in chief will be beginning, and of course we'll do our update on that over the weekend, and it's going to be interesting to see all that. Very interesting. Your thoughts on how this all ended, how the prosecution's case in chief wrapped up, not just today, but the whole thing. Maybe we'll do a video on that too. I'm curious. Tell me in the comments section. And if you're listening to us on whatever podcast platform, check us out on YouTube. You can comment on everything there, or you can also join me on social media pretty much anywhere, or Twitter, X, at Tony B Pod. Every place else, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you can listen to us, watch us pretty much anywhere. So, all right. Can't wait to see those comments. It was a dramatic day. My name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.